counting every vote. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we'll tell you why the local board that canvasses Duval County votes is under scrutiny. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we speak with Omarosa Manigault Newman. The former Trump aide wrote a best-selling book after leaving the White House. She now lives in Jacksonville. We'll get her thoughts on the president, the election, and living on the First Coast. But first this hour, the latest on the pandemic, the statewide positive rate of COVID inched upward overnight to 7.78%. The state now has a total of 786,311 cases of COVID. Hospitalizations around the state are beginning to climb upward once again as well. So the bottom line is this: the pandemic is still very much with us. Mayor Lenny Curry has extended a mandatory mask mandate for the city for another month. So keep your masks on, please. It is still the best tool we have to slow the transmission of this disease and keep all of us safe. Now, amidst the pandemic, we want to pivot to some election news because, of course, voting is happening now. The election is almost upon us. And this week, the Duval County Canvassing Board came under fire. This is a three-member board of local public officials in charge of processing and counting ballots in the upcoming election. The board runs the risk of having all of its work undone if they continue to violate Florida's Sunshine Law. That's according to First Amendment experts. It could even potentially delay Florida's election results. With more on this, we are pleased to welcome Andrew Pantazzi. He's been covering this story for several days now in the Florida Times-Union. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Also on the line, Brad Ashwell, the Florida State Director of the group All Voting is Local. Hi, Brad.
Hi, good morning.
And here is our question to callers. What are your thoughts about the Duval County Canvassing Board fighting efforts to have media cover its work in terms of television cameras, photography? Eventually, the Canvassing Board has agreed, after a lot of scrutiny and back and forth, to a Zoom stream of its work. We're going to explain how this all shook out, and we want your calls. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Andrew Pantazzi, let's begin with you. You've done an outstanding job of keeping the heat on this canvassing board, which consists of a retired judge, the Duval County Supervisor of Elections, Mike Hogan, and Jacksonville City Councilman Michael Boylan, the former CEO of this company, we should say. You've done an excellent job of explaining in the Times Union and also on social media what the controversy is around their activities. Can you explain for listeners that haven't been following this closely why this became such a flashpoint issue this week as people continue to cast ballots?
Yeah, so it started a little earlier in the month. On October 9th, the canvassing board had a meeting that it called its logic and accuracy test of the voting machines. At that meeting, the media attended, candidates attended, parties attended, and all that was noticed on that meeting is that that was happening. After everybody but one person left, the canvassing board other matters, which was approving wholesale changes to how the canvassing board operates. For those who are unfamiliar with the canvassing board, it's most people are. I was not entirely familiar with it other than what I know about from recounts. But prior to Election Day, the canvassing board takes those mail ballots that come in that get rejected by the machine. When you're in person, if something gets rejected by the machine, you can fix it right there. But if something gets rejected by the machine that's mailed in, they then have to correct it. So sometimes that's because there are stray marks or somebody uses blue ink or somebody overvotes. They vote for too many bubbles. Or they don't correctly fill in the bubbles, and they have to fix those. They do that prior to Election Day to make sure that we have a quick, smooth vote count. Governor DeSantis even gave them extra time this year to ensure that they could get all that vote counting done prior to Election Day for ballots that arrived before Election Day. What happened at this October 9th meeting is the canvassing board, which is three people, voted to change the rules very suddenly before the election. And they changed them to make it much less transparent. Some of those changes included saying that observers can no longer object to the canvassing board's decisions. So that means if you have
the Republican or Democratic Party that disagrees with what they're doing, there's nothing they can do about it. The other thing is they said there's going to be no photography.
And if you could get closer to your phone, Andrew, we're just having a little trouble hearing you.
Listen, understand, in Florida, you have very open what are called sunshine laws. These laws require that board meetings be open to the public and that they cannot ban any type of recording or photography that is not disruptive. This has been the case for decades in Florida. This is nothing new. And Jacksonville has had its own history of problems with the Sunshine Law, most notably when we had pension reform that got reversed because it was not handled appropriately in the sunshine. Pension reform that had passed ended up getting canceled under the Alvin Brown administration because it was not appropriately handled. And now we're facing a potential risk that that is repeated here. Because they are refusing to let any member of the public photograph or record these meetings, it's possible that we could face a scenario where a judge says, we're throwing out all of the work you've done to date, and you're going to have to redo the work in appropriately sunshine meetings. So far, the canvassing board has been very cavalier in their response. They have been repeatedly, I mean, it's hard to come up with a word other than arrogant and overly calm. They do not seem worried about this when they talk about it. And it's really baffling to me why this close to an election day you would change rules the way that they have.
Andrew, we're having a little trouble hearing you. If you could get a little bit closer to your mic, your source, that would be helpful. Right. Andrew, quick follow-up before we go to Brad Ashwell. After quite a bit of scrutiny came down on the heads of this three-man board, they did back down on their initial stance, correct? And they are now allowing a Zoom video stream so that people who want to observe their process can do so. Is that right?
That's correct. And I apologize. My phone is giving me some problems. I hope this is clear.
Yeah,
now.
That's great.
So they did. So initially, they also said they were not going to be live streaming the work that they were doing. So there'd be no photography, no video recording, and they would not live stream. Now they are live streaming part of the work that they are doing. Calvin, you cannot be in here right now. I'm sorry, this is the joys of parenting and having children doing school online at home.
We can relate, believe me. You know what, while you deal with that, Andrew, let's go to Brad Ashwell. Brad Ashwell, you're the Florida State Director of All Voting is Local. The Duval County Canvassing Board really did resist more transparency and oversight of its work. Although we are now getting a Zoom stream, it was pointed out to them by a number of lawyers and activists that other large Florida metros allow a video stream or photography of their work. Duval County dug in its heels for several days and said, no, we don't care. We're not going to do this. They are now allowing more oversight. You work with canvassing boards and elections officials all over the state. So what are your thoughts about this whole situation?
Well, our first question when we heard about what was happening in Duval from people on the ground there, they alerted us right after the procedures were adopted. Our first step was really to look around the state and see what other counties were doing, see if this was going to be the new norm or if it was an outlier. And it does seem to be an outlier, Duval, and just this move towards almost making the process secretive. We're happy that they've conceded somewhat and responded to input from, lawyers and parties and individuals, to at least add Zoom. And I think they still have some tweaking to do before that's really where it needs to be. But I think it's just as important that there are physical opportunities for people to attend the meeting. And, obviously COVID-19 is a concern and they have to limit the people in the room. That's understandable. But most counties will set up overflow rooms where people can sit and watch on a screen, where they're nearby. And that's going to become more and more important as we get closer to election day or on election day, maybe even after, if all the votes aren't counted on the night of, which is a distinct possibility. I mean, all this is in the context of, the good news is we're seeing record numbers of voter turnout, which is exactly what we want to see. And a lot of voters are voting by mail. I mean, over 4 million in the state have already voted by mail. The problem is that a lot of the issues that are popping up are signature related and things that will go before canvassing boards, whether it's the lack of a signature or a signature that's not matching up. I think it's important for voters to know that they can, you know, avoid any problems relating to this by just making sure they fill out their vote by mail ballot correctly and making sure they use the signature that's on their either their driver's license or what they put on their voter registration form when they signed up. So that, I mean, that's within voters' power to make sure they've signed their ballot correctly. But once before the canvassing board, it's supposed to be a public process. I mean, both the Constitution and state law, articulate this very clearly. And the precedent is there too. I mean, supervisors in the past have made this very accessible. My understanding is of local government in Jacksonville makes it, city council meetings public via Zoom. So this is really disturbing to us, especially given the gravity of this election, how many vote-by-mail ballots are likely to go before canvassing boards, the importance of making sure every vote counts. And, it's really critical. The press is really the eyes and ears for the public on this process.
And I want to give kudos to the Times Union on their coverage for this. We've been trying to cover it as well here at WJCT. We did have Supervisor of Elections Mike Hogan on the show last week and asked him about this. We do want your calls right now at 549-2937. Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just kind of want to make a comment. The topic that you're having this morning, I wish it was an unnecessary topic, and here's why I say that. I kind of wish we would go back to a more traditional way of voting. If you want to vote by mail, then request an absentee ballot. If you want to go vote early, various polling stations are open early, or you can show up on election day. But when it comes to voter confidence in our voting procedures, when you have situations where you have folks who are trying to analyze a ballot, thinking back on the whole dangling Chad bit in 2000, or if you look at even something as benign as a drop box for your ballots in a stadium parking lot, I just don't think that does a lot to instill confidence in the voters, because the more people you have putting their fingers on and handling the ballots, the more opportunity there is for that potential voter fraud, if you will, inconsistency in calculating the vote. So personally, I would just like to see us go back to more of a traditional way and not even have to have this discussion of whether or not a camera can live feed someone looking at a ballot.
Thanks, Mark. You know, Andrew Pantazzi, this really, in addition to the First Amendment issues you've raised, this also had to do with trust and transparency. The other day, the former supervisor of elections, Jerry Holland, who's now the Duval County property appraiser and who won widespread praise for his handling of the supervisor of elections office, he called into this show unprompted the other day when we were discussing this and said, look, they need to open this up to more oversight to ensure voter trust in the process. And we have a tweet here I want to bounce off you from Stephanie. How did we wind up with three white male Republicans on this important body? They could be doing the best job in the world, but the lack of representation would undermine public confidence. And so there are two things going on here. One, the initial refusal to allow cameras or video streaming, and then also the fact that in this closely watched swing county of Duval, the canvassing board is made up of three white male Republicans. That went over, I think it's fair to say, with a lot of voters, like a lead balloon.
Yeah, I got to say, I think it's really important to contrast what's happening now with how things were going under Jerry Holland. For listeners who are new to the area, who maybe only knew 2000 from television screens and did not live it, Duval County was a complete nightmare in 2000. We had 26,000 votes that were thrown out, most of which were because of overvotes, because the ballot explicitly gave people wrong instructions on how to vote. And so Jerry Holland came into the office after that, and he did a lot. He was a white Republican, like Mike Hogan is. He also appointed a Democrat as his number two in the office. He really went out into the community. He went to voting rights activists. He courted them. He spoke to them. He asked, what do you need from me? He really pushed getting turnout up. And that's a strong contrast from Mike Hogan, who, it should be said, is a close friend of Jerry Holland personally. They go to the same church. However, they have such a contrast in the way they've handled this. There were voting rights activists, Brad Ashwell, on this call right now. He was one of them who were trying to meet with Mike Hogan throughout the summer, and he would not meet with them until just before the election. There was a lot going on where he has not done a good job of meeting with members of the public to explain what is happening, and that is extended to this canvassing board. This canvassing board continues to see its job as one that is pretty dismissive of the public. And it's really surprising. Again, even if this were the right choice to make, even if you were to say, I agree with the canvassing board, why would you change the rules on October, just before the election? Why change the rules so drastically this close to the election in Florida, in a swing county, where you're going to risk having all of the work you've done thrown out, and you're going to risk...
And let me jump in and ask you, you're saying they're running the risk of having the work thrown out if there's litigation around their activities. Can you explain that more fully?
Yeah, so the way it works in Florida is we have a very expansive open sunshine law that says board meetings need to be open to the public, and that openness includes they are not allowed to ban what is called non-disruptive recording and photography. This is true in courthouses, this is true at city council, this is true any board meeting, and they are somehow saying that doesn't apply to them. They won't give any legal analysis for why. They're just asserting that they don't believe that that applies to them. On top of that, there's also a ban against what's called inaudible discussions.
Okay.
Media have asked to put microphones up to the board so that we can hear them, and they're refusing.
And they've refused to do that. If I could, I just want to get Brad Ashwell back on.
Yeah.
Brad, you run All Voting as local Florida state director. You have met with the supervisor of elections, Hogan, after many asks, correct?
Yes. There were attempts for, I think I even drove over there at one point thinking I had a meeting and then got declined when I went to the door last year. We tried to meet with him on a number of issues. We wanted him to expand drop boxes. We wanted him to, he removed early voting sites at both the universities, and that was an issue not only to us, but to, local activists and lots of folks, namely the Edward Waters College, a historically black college, where the site was beneficial to not only the students, but those in the surrounding community. And a lot of folks in the community feel that really, they basically pulled a early voting site out of a black community and put it in a white area, the Prime Osborne. So, I think that's not the worst site, but there's some issues.
Yeah, I mean, the Prime Osborne, I would kind of call a neutral site, though. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Guys, I know you want to keep talking. Let me just get a couple more calls on the air, if I could. AJ in Arlington. AJ, go ahead.
Good morning. I have two quick questions. It was a ballot that was sent in, and they blackened in both John Rutherford and Donna Deegan on the ballot, and I think the Kempson board chose Rutherford. I want to know, how do they make those decisions when both boxes are blacked in? And my next question is, is there a variety of people on the canvassing board, like Democrats, Independents, Republicans, or is it just all Republicans?
Right, AJ. Yeah, part of the reason this has become controversial is it is a three-member board, and it is comprised this time around of all Republicans, all white as well, all men. Andrew, can you explain to that listener about some of the votes that they're looking at where they can't figure out the voter's intent and they try to decide who the vote should go to?
Yeah, so the vast majority of decisions are very simple. Someone rested their pen in a circle, so there's a tiny, tiny little dot, and they know that was not intended as a vote. Those are simple. There's some where people fill in two bubbles or more. And if you make remarks next to those bubbles, you say, did not mean this or wrong, this one instead, that's easier to understand. In that case, with Donna Deegan and John Rutherford, I could not understand the handwriting. They would not allow us to photograph it. They were not live streaming at the time. So you're going to just have to trust that they could read handwriting that I could not read when they said that that should go to John Rutherford. As for the composition of the board, by statute, it's supposed to be the chair of a county commission, in our case, city council, or it can be a different designee. In this case, it's Michael Boylan, who is designated by council. And then it's supposed to be a county judge. In this case, it's supposed to be Gary Flower. However, he has not been attending the meetings, and so Brent Shore, a senior judge, is filling in his stead. And then the third member is supposed to be the election supervisor.
Yeah, and you know, the president of the city council, Tommy Hazzuri, appeared on this show the other day, and he said the reason Michael Boylan was chosen from the council is because he was the one who was properly trained to do this work. Joyce Morgan, an African-American Democrat, was also chosen, but only as an alternate. In hindsight, Brad, they might have done better to put Joyce Morgan into this mix. Here's an email. I want to wrap this quickly. We're about to hit a break, guys. But Emily tweets the show, what happens next? How can we be confident in the Duval vote count? Brad Ashwell.
Well, I mean, like I said earlier, make sure you've filled out your own ballot correctly. You can track your ballot online. If you see any issues or it's not being tabulated, call the office. But I think, you know, it's right for the public to call and put pressure on them to make this process more accessible and transparent. To answer an earlier caller, the Canvas Board has been around since vote-by-mail and absentee balloting, which is the same thing, has existed in Florida. And it really exists to make sure we have integrity in the election, that the voters aren't wrongly signing or impostering somebody else, and to make sure people don't get wrongly rejected. I mean, as a voter access group, we're mostly concerned that Black and Hispanic voters who typically see their ballots rejected at a higher rate than white voters will be adversely impacted. So, you know, there are things within your power. Just make sure you've filled out your ballot correctly. Use that ballot tracking device and call the office if you have any questions. And call the office about this. I mean, you should be able to watch this process. It shouldn't be a secretive, you know, Wizard of Oz behind the scenes process that nobody is aware of.
Thank you so much, Brad Ashwell. He's the Florida State Director of All Voting is Local, and I would refer everyone to Andrew's reporting, Andrew Pantazzi, in the Florida Times Union. More about this on our website, too, at wjct.org. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
And much more still ahead on the show later. Some good news for your week. It's our What's Good Wednesdays, but up next.
I never imagined, let me be very clear, that Donald Trump would, for instance, separate children from their parents, you know, at the border, put kids in cages.
An extended conversation coming up with former reality star, Trump White House aide, author, and now Jacksonville resident, Omarosa Manigault Newman. That's next.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
You blink, you reach for that handful of chips, you scroll through social media, it's all happening on automatic pilot. When it comes to being well-informed, being more mindful of where you get your news can make a big difference in how you see the world. To get your information in context, to gain different perspectives, and to understand real issues, choose NPR as your go-to source for election news. 2020 election, it's time to listen.
Here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. She's a former reality star and Trump White House aide. Omarosa Manigault Newman also wrote a best-selling book about her time working for the president. She now lives here in Jacksonville with her husband. And as early voting continues this week, she is speaking out about the election. I had an extended conversation with Omarosa last week. Let's listen. Omarosa, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's so good to finally connect.
It's good to have you on the show. Many around town know that you are a Jacksonville resident now, after your time in the White House. And you've been in the news lately because of a legal skirmish with President Trump. They want you to pay them for your book, Unhinged, about your time in the White House. They say you haven't honored an NDA.
although we did learn this week that they actually are delinquent in paying an arbitrator that is supposed to handle this matter. So I wanted to begin by asking you about this. They're saying that you broke an agreement with the White House to keep quiet about your time there. What's the truth about that?
I want to say, first of all, that the White House shouldn't be issuing NDAs. I think that it's very important that the American people be allowed to know what happens, particularly since the American people fund what happens in the government. So let's be very clear. Non-disclosure agreements for government employees they're illegal. I mean, and they have no validity, and they've been thrown out in every single case. And the reality is, the reason that Donald Trump is suing me, like he has tried to sue the last, 15, 20 people who've written a book, including his own niece, Mary Trump, is because of retaliation and his desire to kind of silence his critics. And so I'm very pleased that the country is kind of getting to know the truth in terms of this pattern, because there's this long pattern of Donald Trump suing people as an intimidation tactic. But I have an incredible lawyer. His name is John Phillips. He's here in Jacksonville, and he has been doing such a great job in the case. And you're absolutely right. Donald Trump has not paid his legal bills. I'm laughing only because, I think the city has also been left holding a bill when there were promises made by the RNC that the city wouldn't have to pay 1 cent for the convention coming here. And so there's a pattern that these folks just don't pay their bills. And Donald Trump has not paid the arbitrators, and they are not happy.
Well, if he doesn't pay the arbitrator in this dispute, what will happen with the case? Will it be tossed out?
I am not certain. I mean, I've seen all the headlines just like you. I've talked to my attorney. And, he will have to pay, of course, our legal fees. And then the arbitrators could decide to punish him and rule against him and dismiss the case.
Well, it's interesting to follow this latest twist in your interactions with the president, because as millions know, you first met Donald Trump when you appeared on his show, The Apprentice. This goes all the way back to 2003. And became a national figure.
Where has 17 years gone?
Right, I know. Yeah, it's been almost two decades. And so you became a household name back then. And when you went to work in the Trump White House, you said you admired Donald Trump. You were excited to work for the president. What changed? What was it about your time in the White House that made you go from being a fan of the president to a critic?
Well, I think we need to put this in context. Long before I met Donald Trump on The Apprentice, I worked in the Clinton White House for President Bill Clinton. I was Deputy Associate Director for Presidential Personnel in the White House. And when I met Donald Trump in 2003, he was a Democrat. Ivanka was a Democrat. Jared Kushner was a Democrat. Steve Mnuchin was a Democrat. All of these folks who, you're absolutely right that I was working with. I was never a fan. They were my coworkers. But when I worked with them as colleagues, they were Democrats. And so when I met him, his policy priorities aligned with mine. I was a Democrat, and Donald was a Democrat, and he used to be pro-choice. He used to have very liberal views. And so as you can imagine, in the last 17 years, people who were fans of The Apprentice have watched, just like I have, Donald Trump kind of morph into this extreme personality who's out and hell-bent on destruction. Certainly, I wish I had a crystal ball to know how corrupt he would become because of his access to power. And we know that power tends to corrupt people. And so I never imagined, let me be very clear, that Donald Trump would, for instance, separate children from their parents, at the border, and put kids in cages. These are things that I did not know when I signed up to be on The Apprentice in 2003, and I don't even pretend to even imagine what is going to happen if in fact he is reelected for four more years. I don't have that special crystal ball to tell you how much worse it's going to get. But you're absolutely right. Donald Trump was my colleague, my coworker on these shows. And I had an incredible opportunity to serve this country. And I have to tell you that any chance you get to serve your country, I think people should step up to do so. And I had an incredible opportunity because I was, you know, as you may know, the only African-American senior staffer appointed to the White House. And so I also carried with me a responsibility to make sure that these policy decisions that were being made did not harm my community and in some ways helped to improve them. So,
and let's talk about that, because you were the administration's African-American liaison. You faced criticism from some African-Americans for even agreeing to take this role at the White House with this particular administration. What was...
Let me just stop you there before we go there.
Okay.
Anytime you're in leadership, anytime that you decide to lead in a country as large as this, you're going to be a recipient of criticism. And let's be clear, African Americans are not a monolith. And so on one side, of course, I was receiving a tremendous amount of praise. And criticism is to be expected when you're in a position such as that, sitting in the office, one of the most powerful positions, I think, that you can, overseeing a budget of trillions and trillions of dollars that could impact people. And so criticism comes with the territory, but I'm sure that your listeners know that leading people comes with criticism and critiques, and I'm built for it because, as I mentioned, this is my 23rd year in politics.
Right, and I think people see you as smart, tough, uncompromising, able to take criticism, certainly. Do you feel that you accomplished anything with regard to outreach and uplift with the African-American community? Do you think you did some good while you were in the White House, or did it just become too difficult to carry out, to execute your portfolio?
Oh, no. I tried not to get distracted by all of the things that Donald was doing. I mean, could you imagine in the first 2 weeks of the administration, Donald and Steve Miller decided to implement a travel ban against Muslims coming into this country. You can imagine, as the liaison to the African-American community, members of the Muslim faith were outraged. And I was the person who had to answer to all of the faith leaders who were just appalled by his behavior. But in terms of the things that I accomplished, these are the things that don't get a headline, you know, helping to advocate for black farmers who the Department of Commerce may have overlooked in all of its funding, helping to empower infrastructure deals for inner city schools, helping to make sure historically black colleges and universities got an increase. That's probably one of my proudest things, but also working with cities like Flint, for instance, that had to deal with a water crisis, helping with the Justice Department in terms of the reforms that I was seeking in civil rights and policing. I mean, there's such a long list. I don't think we have enough time on your program of the things that I worked on that were accomplished. But those things aren't sexy. You know what I mean? They don't make the headlines, and people don't want to give ink to them. But I actually was very effective of doing those things because I didn't include Donald in them. You know, if you mentioned Donald Trump in these meetings, people didn't want to work with you. But my ability to, for instance, go to the UN and advocate through USAID for funding for famine for countries that were hurting, like Nigeria, that needed food and resources. And our country committed $100 million because of the advocacy that we did. So, yes, there were a tremendous amount of things that I did. And unfortunately, when you serve at the pleasure of the president, you don't get to brag about what you did as an individual. You say the administration accomplished X, Y, Z in the administration. And so I never ran around tooting my own horn, but certainly I'm very proud of the work I did with veterans and faith groups and women's groups. And, you know, it was difficult leading with Donald Trump as president because he was so divisive and he always got distracted. He was never focused on whatever policy things we tried to convince him to do or to work on. But I stayed the course, and I'm very, very proud that I was able to make a change in my year in the White House.
We're speaking with Omarosa Manigault Newman, writer, television star, former political aide to the president, and a Jacksonville resident. Her 2018 book, a bestseller, is titled Unhinged, an insider's account of the Trump White House.
Wait, before we go on to my book, I just want to give a plug also for my wonderful husband. The reason that I am a Jacksonville resident,
yeah,
because I married the man of my dreams, Pastor John Allen Newman, who has pastored here in Jacksonville for 36 years at the Sanctuary at Mount Calvary Church.
And don't you lead the church with him, essentially? Don't you work in ministry, too?
I work hand in hand with him in ministry, but he is the pastor. I am over our faith and outreach ministry, and some of the things that I work on, for instance, on Thanksgiving, the week before Thanksgiving, we're giving away dinners and turkeys to families at our church the Saturday before Thanksgiving, because so many families here in the Jacksonville area are hurting because of the pandemic and the economic conditions in this country. And so that was one of the initiatives that I'm working on right now to make sure that families have food and resources that they need so that they can have food on the table, particularly for Thanksgiving.
Sure. So it's a very different life from working in the White House. And so how are you enjoying life in Jacksonville, Florida?
Well, I have to tell you, this is such a wonderful change from the lifestyle that I led when as you mentioned, I was in Hollywood, or when I lived in New York, or most recently living in D.C. Jacksonville is a beautiful city, and the people are wonderful. And I love the community that we have with our church, with my neighbors, with the faith groups that I work with, and the community groups. You know, we always go down every year, and we serve at Clara White Mission and support Jacoby every year. And when it comes to around this time, I always get so excited because it is a chance to connect with neighbors, to revisit friends. Even in the midst of the pandemic, we're still doing the work in the communities. I absolutely love it. I love going to the beach. I love riding my bike. I ride a mountain bike, and I do 15, 16 miles a day whenever I can.
Hmm.
And you can only
no mountains,
do those
though.
No, yeah. I do miss my mountain climbing.
Climbing.
In fact, I was training to climb Mount Kilimanjaro before the pandemic hit. I was supposed to climb in June with a girlfriend who overcome cancer, but that was canceled. But in the meantime, I've been riding at least 100 miles a month, so it's been going well.
Got it. Let me ask you, though, if I could, a little bit more about your book. In the book, you question the president's mental health. You said he is an outright racist. And you shared a lot of tapes that you made from inside the White House. At what point did you start recording people, and what was it that made you feel you needed to do that?
Let me be very clear, first of all. The name of my book is called Unhinged, which I think is appropriately titled because America has watched the president become unhinged in the last 3 years. And if people want to buy the book, of course, it's available on Amazon. And my Twitter is @Omarosa. I respond to all of your inquiries, so please feel free to reach out. You mentioned that I recorded a lot in the White House. That's just not the case. I did, however, record what happened to me in the Situation Room. And I want to say this to any of the female listeners who are listening at home. If a man ever takes you into a room that has no windows and locks the door and start making threats towards you, if you do have an opportunity to protect yourself, do so. And that is the situation that I found myself in the White House with John Kelly, who essentially put me into a room that had no doors, that I couldn't exit if I wanted to, and who repeatedly told me that I could not leave. And that is the reason that I did that. And I think
is that the only conversation you recorded with John Kelly?
That is the only one that I had. Yeah, it was the only one that was necessary. And I'm sure, Melissa, if somebody took you into a room at the radio station right now that didn't have any windows and locked, it was only unlocked from the outside, I think that you would be very, very nervous. And so it's important that people understand that. And that's why I shared what happened to me in my book, Unhinged. But I also share some of the times that Donald Trump, I think, betrayed his oath of office. And I took an oath to the Constitution. I think that anyone in my position would recognize that some of these impulses that were downright dangerous and were harmful to our country also needed to be shared. So I think that it's important that people hear these stories. And thank you for mentioning Unhinged. As you know, it premiered number one on the New York Times bestsellers list.
Let me ask you, because certainly we're so close to the election and we're already seeing robust early voting in Florida and voting by mail. In Florida, just as it is most elections, Donald Trump and Joe Biden are neck and neck. The state could be decided by a point or less. Certainly people who are voting for Vice President Biden are enthusiastically doing that. But at the same time, people who are fans of the president are excited to vote for him. There aren't a lot of undecided voters out there. So what are your thoughts about Florida's importance in this, in deciding the outcome of this election?
I can't even just put in words the magnitude of the importance of Florida. I have to just tell you a funny story. When I was working for, first Al Gore was the first person I worked with in the White House. I was appointed to the vice president's office, and then, of course, I went to work for Bill Clinton. But I worked for Gore's campaign, and they sent me down to Florida when things kind of went crazy. So some of the first weeks that I ever spent in Florida was during the crazy Gore campaign, the recount, and then ultimately the decision made by the Supreme Court. But I wanted to share that with you because I know personally the importance of Florida because my first devastating loss as a political operative was what happened with the Bush v. Gore case and what unfolded in front of my own eyes. And so I think that in a country this great, everyone has the right to choose their own candidate. And yes, there are people who are enthusiastic about Donald Trump, and there are people who are enthusiastic about Biden. But to me, the most important thing for individuals is to vote their interests. Vote for the person who helps you in your community with policy issues that are important to you. So let me tell you what's important in the Newman household. Decency is important in the Newman household. Honesty, someone who has empathy, who cares about 212,000 Americans who've died, someone who has a plan, someone who will be considerate to the economic woes this country is facing and will be able to address those things. But there are other issues. My mother, who is beautiful and 75 years old, she also is concerned about the future of Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and those types of things. And so we are looking for the candidate who speaks to those issues. And you, listeners, should look on each website of the candidate and look to the person who is speaking to the issues that are important to you.
Well, Omarosa, it's good to have you on this show, and thanks for joining us. It's certainly an unprecedented time, and having you here in Jacksonville to tell your stories, it's interesting to make sure our listeners hear it. She's Omarosa Manigault Newman. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Melissa. It's been great.
And in a moment, some good news and notes for your week. We'll be right back.
President Trump says he wants to make it harder for poor people with government subsidies to move to wealthy areas. But moving to the suburbs has never been easy for low-income families.
It's prejudice that is preventing the housing from being developed. As an African-American woman, if I can actively engage in changing someone's life more positively, I have to.
The fight over affordable housing this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Marco Werman. On the world, we look for outside perspectives.
I'm worried for the African Americans in America right now. I'm scared for them. I mean, there are very few Nigerians who don't have family in the U.S. We expect better.
Looking at the U.S. from beyond our borders, it's the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Arizona Democrats think they can turn the state blue in November for the first time in 24 years, but it won't come easy.
Panic is not a plan. We need to be out there knocking on doors, reminding our families to get out, make sure they are casting their ballot.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Anti-racist protests have done more than rallied marchers against police brutality in the Trump administration. It's been a call to arms for militia groups across the country.
You always want to allow police to do their job, but this is why we have the Second Amendment, because sometimes things fall apart.
I'm Jen White. We've got a special report next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, tonight, don't miss a special She is Fierce Women's Wednesdays cocktail event you can Zoom into right from your own home. The featured speakers are Melissa Hardwick, Vice President at Acosta, and Run with Donna founder and political candidate Donna Deegan. I spoke with them.
So the theme of this event is Step into Leadership, and you both have a lot to say about that. Melissa, let's begin with you. You are not only a vice president at Acosta, but you're also the founder of an organization called Brown Girls in the Boardroom, of which you are one. So a brown woman, I should say. So what will we hear? What will we hear from you at this event?
You know, thank you again, Melissa, for having us. And I'm certainly just honored to be on this platform with Donna, excited about what's to come in that space. But, you know, when I think about Brown Girls in the Boardroom and what inspired me to do this, I think about some of the great opportunities that I've had as an African-American woman in my career. And while I had many opportunities, I've also had some challenges and lots of lessons learned. And I've been partnering in the community, trying to be a mentor to some young girls. And I see that one element that perhaps those girls that have been underserved traditionally, there's an element that's missing. And that is, how do I get a seat at the table? What is required of me, right? What is this corporate culture of leadership that so many of boardrooms that we see today are missing that brown face? And so I've just pledged that, you know what, Melissa, how can you help? How can you help in that environment? And so I was raised, Melissa, in a home where being a servant leader was not uncommon for my parents. And I think it was just intrinsic. And I don't think that God was going to allow me to rest until I kind of stepped out and started something along these lines. And so that is what birthed Brown Girls in the Boardroom.
Excellent. So you will be talking about that and also what you've learned in your career in business, some great advice for women in business that will be zooming into this event to learn about leadership. Donna Deegan, of course, everyone knows your name. You are a current candidate for Congress, but you are also a nonprofit head as founder of the Donna Marathon. So there's a lot you have to share in this space as well.
Well, I just think it's so important for people to, when they see a need, to step out there. And, you know, I think I've learned over my years of marathoning, after having started the marathon and run so many, that that it truly is the hard that makes it good. And I think that when you see that things are difficult, that's the time that you want to step in and try to make as much of a difference as you possibly can. So I think it's simply a matter of taking that mantle and running as far as you possibly can with it. And I think it's so needed right now, these voices of female leadership. I think that's so clear now more than ever, that we need more and more women stepping into their power, stepping into that space, and holding up their hand and say, I am willing to be that servant leader. Because I think Melissa has it exactly right. I think it's all about servant leadership. And the more we continue to focus on that, I think the more we have an opportunity not only to be more effective leaders, but to really do something that would be transformative, not only for our city, but for our country. And that is to try to get people talking to each other and seeing each other again. And I think women are well suited for that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Melissa, you know, women often have to be encouraged to seek leadership roles. That's not a problem most men have. So what's your, this is a way of encouraging women to not be afraid to seek leadership roles. Yeah.
When you think about, you know, who really can get the job done, think about the diversity and the ideas that we bring to the table, right? I think companies overall are really missing out by being limited in having women in leadership roles.
Ladies, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Looking forward to it.
That's tonight. I'll be joining for a bit myself. Go to sheisfiercehq.com/events. Well, most local businesses hit hard by the pandemic are soldiering on. That includes the wildlife sanctuary Caddy Shack Ranch. They're having costume contests and other family fun during the day on Halloween. Here's Executive Director Kurt Lojudice.
Costume contests. We're going to be having folks from children to adults. So we're going to have a couple different avenues where folks can actually get some good prizes for that event to have them come out dressed.
Visit Caddy Shack Ranch on Halloween for a special family fun day, and they are open every day from 1 to 3. And celebrity chef Kenny Gilbert and his wife in the final stages of opening up their first upscale fast casual restaurant, Silky's Chicken and Champagne Bar. This will be at Walnut Street and I think 6th in historic Springfield. Chef Kenny, of course, is known for his time on several Food Network shows. He's a great chef, and he'll be on the air with us Thursday morning to give us a taste of what's on his menu. And this is just also a taste of our What's Good Wednesdays, some positive news and notes from the week that we focus on each Wednesday on this program. You can also subscribe to What's Good Wednesdays, our free e-newsletter. Go to WJCT.org and add your name. It goes out later today. And that's our show. Thanks for listening, and to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8, or our podcast will be up later today, wherever you listen. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. A quick reminder that mask mandate has been extended for another month, so mask up, Duval. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.